You can open your Bibles to the book of 2 Samuel, chapter 18. We looked last week at chapter 17 and 18, the first part of chapter 18. We saw that Ahithophel, who was once David's friend and counselor, had advised Absalom that a quick pursuit of David while he was weak and weary would be very successful. And that was good advice. But we know that God defeated that good advice, and He used in His providential will, He used David's spy, Hushai, to give different advice, and advice that for some reason Absalom and his advisors felt was good. So because of that, David was alerted to the situation and was instructed through the spy network that they had set up that he should escape as quickly as possible across the Jordan River to the land of Gilead. And he did. And when he got there, we know that he received aid from the people of the land. There were still people who were supportive of David and had not supported Absalom in his rebellion. And not only that, but it allowed David to garner a larger number of troops. He went way beyond the 600 that he had at one point in time, so that he had thousands of troops that were there with him in the wilderness there on the other side of the Jordan in Gilead. Absalom led the pursuit of David, and he led a vast army to come after David. And they battled together in the woods of Ephraim. There were very, very thick trees in that woods, and it says that David's troops overthrew Absalom's troops. In fact, there was a great slaughter of 20,000 people that died. But interesting, certainly this was the work of God. This was God's victory that was won here, because it tells us that the woods devoured more people than the sword devoured that day. So we certainly see the hand of God in bringing that judgment and that disaster upon Absalom because of his rebellion. Not so much his rebellion against David, but his rebellion against God, because that's what it was. We saw in the process of this battle that Absalom, riding his mule in the trees, got his head caught. Probably very likely caught by his hair, his luxurious head of hair that he had. And he simply hung there from that tree, helplessly and shamefully hanging from a tree. I can't imagine what it must have felt like. He tried to get loose, I'm sure, in every way he could. Simply wasn't going to happen. He was found by a soldier who took word back to Joab. The soldier wasn't going to do anything himself. He was afraid of killing the king's son. To kill the king's son was something that might not sit too well with the king, and he certainly had shown that in other instances. Joab, when he hears that, is appalled that the man didn't kill him, and he goes right back and thrust three spears in his heart, and he and the men that were with him, 10 young men with him, they surrounded him and killed him as he hung there in that tree. We talk about the fact that Absalom, his children were all dead by this time, particularly his sons, we know. And so there was nobody to carry on his name, so he had erected a monument, basically, to himself. Probably, no doubt, intending to be buried there with a great pomp and circumstance and all that, but it didn't happen. Joab and his men simply buried him in a pit there in the woods and covered him up with stones. Again, kind of a shameful end for a shameful man. Tonight, we're going to look at how David responds to all this. Go back with me to chapter 18 for just a second and look at verse 5. Remember what David had told. He had three generals in charge of his army. He divided between these three men. And he look at verse 5. Now, the king had commanded Joab, Abishai, and Ittai, saying, "Deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom." And everybody heard it. All the people heard when the king gave all the captains order concerning Absalom. Well, Absalom's dead now, so that the situation has come up. Someone's got to go back and tell David what happened. Let's pick up reading in chapter 18 and go down with me to verse 19. It says, "Then Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok," Zadok is the priest, "he said," and this would be to Joab, "let me run now and take the news to the king, how the Lord has avenged him of his enemies." He wants to take the news to David. He cares about David, I think. He was one of those men that was used as a spy. He was sent between the priests, his fathers, and David to give information back and forth of what was going on. So he wants to tell David what's happened, how the Lord has avenged David of his enemies. Well, Joab said to him in verse 20, "You shall not take the news this day, for you shall take the news another day. But today you shall take no news, because the king's son is dead." Why does he not want him to take news today? Why does he say, let's take the news that the king's son is dead another day? Why not take the news back to David? What's he worried about?
Probably he's worried about the fact that David is going to respond in a negative way towards those captains.
He is. How does David feel about this son in particular? Yeah, he's for some reason, I don't know why, for some reason Absalom is his favorite. He loves his son dearly to the point where he doesn't even think clearly when it comes to how he deals with his son. I think Joab is exactly that. I think he's worried how David's going to react. He says, this is not the day to tell it. Let's wait another day. We're going to not take any news to him today. And then I guess he changes his mind, because in verse 21, Joab said to the Cushite, Cushite very likely a man from Ethiopia, we don't know that for sure, probably just a common servant is who this is. Not somebody close to David, but just a common servant. He said to the Cushite, you go and tell the king what you have seen. And so the Cushite bowed himself to Joab, acknowledges he's going to do this, and he ran. He takes off running. And Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, said again to Joab, but whatever happens, please let me also run after the Cushite. He dearly wants to go and give this news. So Joab said, why will you run, my son, since you have no news ready? There's no news that's really prepared. There's no news that really needs to be given to David. Why would you run and do this? But he allows him to do it. And he said, whatever happens, he said, let me run. So he said to him, run him. So Ahimaaz ran by way of the plain, and what does happen? He outran the Cushite. He gets there first. Not exactly what Joab had in mind, but he outruns him and he gets to David first. Now, we jump over to where David is waiting. Look at verse 24. Now, David was sitting between the two gates, okay? And the watchman went up to the roof over the gate to the wall, lifted his eyes and looked, and there was a man running alone. And the watchman cried out and told the king. And the king says, if he's alone, there's news in his mouth. And he came rapidly and he drew near. If he's alone, he must be just a courier. He must be just a messenger. Because if he wasn't alone, I mean, this would be who coming back? Maybe all of his troops coming back because either they'd won a great victory or they'd defeated. So he's just bringing news. He's a messenger. He's bringing news of some sort. And so he sees him running alone. Now, look at the next verse, verse 26. Then the watchman saw another man running. And the watchman called to the gatekeeper and said, there's another man running alone. And the king said, he also brings news. Both of them must be couriers if they're by themselves. They're both running. He probably wonders why there's two and why they're that close together, but they're bringing news. Now look at the next thing. So the watchman said, I think the running of the first is like the running of Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok. And the king says, he's a good man. He's a good man. And he comes with what?
Good news.
Now, does he come with good news? No. David wants him to, though, doesn't he? Why is David sitting there at the gate watching? Is he concerned about how the troops have fared against Absalom and Absalom's troops? I see some yeses and some noes. What's he really concerned about? Absalom. When they go off to battle, what's the one thing he tells them? Deal gently with my son Absalom. This is my order. This is my command concerning Absalom. You deal gently with him. Now, you can't deal very gently with someone if you throw three spears through their heart. That's not dealing gently. So he's saying, make sure he's kept safe. And that's what he's waiting for. He is expecting and wanting. I don't know if he's expecting. He is wanting so badly to hear good news. And so when he sees Ahimaaz, he says, this is a good man. This is a good man. He must bring good news. So Ahimaaz outran the Cushite. Ahimaaz gets there, verse 28. And he called out and he said to the king, all is well. I'm sure David perked up a little bit. All is well. That sounds good. Because again, what's David thinking about? He's thinking about his son. Now, Ahimaaz doesn't have in mind his son at all. Ahimaaz knows what happened to Absalom. He knows he's dead. So he says, all is well. Then he bowed down with his face to the earth before the king. Because, again, he respects David. He loves David. He's caring about David. And he said, blessed be the Lord your God, who has delivered up the men who raised their hand against my Lord the king. Now, who does he give credit to? Who gets the credit for this victory? God. You know, the person who might have wanted credit would have been Joab. You know, but he doesn't give the credit to Joab. He doesn't give the credit to the army. He gives the credit. God did this. And so we see here a godly man bringing this news. The Lord, Jehovah, your God, who has delivered up the men who raised their hand against my Lord the king. Those who dared to raise their hand against the king, against the Lord's anointed, the king. He says they have been delivered up by God himself. Notice, what does the king ask? Does he ask, how many troops did we lose? Does he ask, how did the battle go? Does he ask anything along those lines? No. One thing and one thing only, the king says, is the young man Absalom safe? Only question he asks. Because basically at this point in time, the only thing he cares about is the young man Absalom safe? And Ahimaaz answered. Now, this is a tough question for him because I believe he knows what happened to Absalom. I believe he absolutely knows that. But this is how he answered. He says, when Joab sent the king's servant and me, your servant, because there's two of them that came, okay? He says, and I saw a great tumult, but I did not know what it was about. There was a great commotion, a big tumult here, but I didn't know what it was about. What does he do? What's he trying to do? Trying to spare the king's feelings here. I mean, we don't want to tell him. And Joab had advised, listen, we don't need to tell him this news today. He doesn't need to hear this news today. He needs to hear this news another day. Joab, I think, had no problem with him hearing the news of the great victory. But he doesn't want him to hear the news about his son Absalom's death. And so I think Ahimaaz followed that direction. He doesn't want to hurt David. But ultimately, what does he do? Does he lie? Well, yeah. If we wanted to be real, real kind to him, we wouldn't say, well, he just didn't tell the whole truth. But notice what he says. I didn't know what it was about. That's a lie. I mean, I'm sorry. That's a lie. So he's trying to spare somebody's feelings, and so and he does that. And so he's trying to avoid hurting David in this way, and that's what he says. Well, he doesn't really get enough information to the king. So the king said, turn aside and you stand there. He said, okay, I've gotten all I can from you. You just stand over there. So he turned aside and he stood still. And just then the Cushite came. Cushite came up, a servant. He doesn't know David very likely. If he does, he doesn't know him as well as Ahimaaz did. And so he comes and the Cushite said, there is good news, my lord, the king. That's pretty much what Ahimaaz said. All is well. There's good news, my lord the king, because in his mind, in the Cushite's mind, is this good news, what he's about to say? It is. It's very good news. This is great news. And in Ahimaaz's mind, all is well with what happened here. And so he says, there's good news, my lord the king, for the Lord, he also gives credit to Jehovah, the Lord has avenged you this day of all those who rose against you, all those who rebelled against you. He says, the Lord has avenged you. Now, who would that include? Who's the leader of that rebellion? Absalom. The Lord has avenged you. Right then and there, you see in that very statement, he blurts out what really happened. The Lord has avenged you on all of those who rebelled against you. And the king said to the Cushite, is the young man Absalom safe? That's what he wants to know. Maybe he already feels in his heart that the answer is not going to be good, but he asked the question because he wants it clearly made known to him. And so the Cushite answered, may the enemies of my lord the king and all who rise against you to do harm be like that young man. That's kind of a clever way of putting it, isn't it? He didn't just come out and say, listen, he's dead. They ran him through with spears and killed him. He's dead. He was hanging in a tree. Doesn't tell him all that. He just says, may the enemies of my lord the king, may all who rise against you to do you harm be like that young man. David knows now what's the situation. He's dead. He knows he's dead. He knows that with that statement that his son is dead. Look at his response in verse 33. It's almost sad to read these verses, to hear how David responds. But look at verse 33. Then the king was deeply moved. This hit him at the soul, the core of his being. He was deeply moved, and he went up to the chamber over the gate. Okay, and he wept. He wept aloud. This is not just shedding tears. This is loud weeping. And he wept, and he says, and as he went, as he's climbing up there, even before he gets there, as he went, he said thus, oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, if only I had died in your place. Oh, Absalom, my son. Just pitiful statement from David. You look at the situation, he says, if only I had died in your place. Why does he say that? He's a parent. That's part of it. Yeah. The loss of a child is difficult. Even a child as rebellious as Absalom is, we already know David loves him. Okay. He loves him, with a great love. No question about that. But so that's part of it because it's his own child. And sometimes we'd say, yeah, I'd rather I had died than my child. That's part of it. What else?
Self-pity.
Self-pity, that's certainly a little bit of it, I think, as well. In fact, that's probably a big part of it.
Guilt. So, I think David feels guilty because he knows that the sword was not in the part.
If he hadn't done what he done.
Yeah, who does this all go? Yeah, whose ultimate fault is all of this that this is happening? It's his. His sin with Bathsheba, his murder of Uriah the Hittite, his cover-up of the whole thing, his lies and deception, everything that he did, this is a part of God's judgment. And so he knows that this is my fault. My son died because of me, is what he's thinking. Now, is that absolutely true?
No, absolutely not.
Yeah, you can't say Absalom is not responsible for his own choices in life. When we look at this young man, he's not really a young man. He had three children and so forth. They were older. He's probably in his 40s right now and so forth. But you look at him, you think, he made some terrible choices himself in life. And very ungodly man, very unspiritual. No, there's no spirituality about him at all.
Why wasn't he this upset with the baby that died? Bathsheba's first child. I mean, that was definitely a child that did not make any decisions against God. And as a judgment, that child died. And you see David mourning and weeping, but then, eating and being fine afterwards.
What does that tell you about what's happened with David's relationship with the Lord at this time versus that time? You see, there's a great difference in David's relationship with the Lord. David had just been confronted with his sin, and he's acknowledged his sin, and he's accepted that. He's accepted God's judgment. Right after that, we see David in a pretty close relationship with the Lord, and his responses and his reactions to everything that happened, including the death of that child, you see that. Now you see that's changed. David's relationship, his walk with the Lord, has been hindered greatly over the last several years. And part of that is, the judgment of God upon his household. And part of that is just his own lack of faith and trust and obedience to God's word and walking in fellowship with the Lord. And so, we see David is not in a good spot spiritually at this time. He's not in a good relationship with the Lord, and it's reflected in his life. And so, as we look at this, grief and sorrow, is that a natural reaction? Is that a perfectly reasonable reaction even for believers? Certainly, yeah. The problem here is this is not just a normal grief. This is not just a grief over the loss of a son. You think about this. David had an inordinate affection for Absalom that was really off the charts of what it should have been. He doted on this child and basically gave him anything he wanted and didn't discipline him, didn't chasten him, didn't correct him, likely didn't teach him much. And as a result, that's why one of the reasons why his life went the direction it did. And yet, doting on him like he did, now when he's dead, we see an inordinate grief and mourning for him because of the relationship and the love that he had. This is excessive grief. This is misplaced grief for a son who doesn't deserve this much grief because he brought all of these things on himself. And so, this is the consequences of sin. The more you get involved in sin, the more you get sucked under sin, the farther you get away from the Lord in your walk, and the more you're affected as far as your judgments, your moral decisions and judgments in life. And you see David's moral decision-making process here as definitely degraded. And that's one of the reasons that he does what he does here. Matthew Henry gave a good analysis of why David's grief, the grief to this extent, was so wrong, was actually sinful. And he said he's to be blamed for five reasons. And I thought these were good. I'm going to share them with you. He said David was to be blamed, number one, for showing so great a fondness for a graceless, however handsome and witty, for a graceless son that was justly abandoned by God and by men. And that's what Absalom is, And yet David shows this tremendous grief for him, not even considering what kind of person he was spiritually. Is it likely that Absalom is saved? There's no evidence of it, is there? There's no evidence that Absalom ever trusted God or obeyed God or even gave a thought for God, for that matter. So he's probably not even saved. I know it's kind of tough to think about that with your own child, but when that child is gone and they're not saved, you have to think about it. You have no relationship. Our most important relationships are not with each other here on this earth. Whether it's husband and wife or mother and son or father and daughter, whatever it might be, our most important relationships with each other are how? Brothers and sisters in Christ, is it not? With your mother, if you're both saved, then your most important relationship and the one that's going to last for all eternity is the fact that you are brother and sister in Christ. He had no relationship with Absalom in regard to spiritual things. His relationship with Absalom was over because Absalom was now dead. And yet he grieved inordinately and had such love and affection for this son who really didn't deserve it. Number two, Henry says he's to be blamed for quarreling, not only with divine providence, the working of God in this, the disposals of which he ought silently to acquiesce to. He ought to have accepted what God did here as the providence of God. And not only that, but he is quarreling with divine justice, the judgments which he ought to adore and which he ought to subscribe to. Absalom deserved the judgment from God that he got, and David should have recognized that and been in agreement with it. Hard as it was, as hard as it would have been, he should have seen that. So he's basically arguing with God over his providential will and over his divine justice. Number three, he is to be blamed for opposing the justice that was done for the nation of Israel. Because, you know, as a king, he was entrusted with the administration of that nation. He is the commander of that nation, of the Lord's people. And which, you know, he ought to put their interests, the public interests, he ought to put those before any natural affection he had for his own family. That was his most important responsibility, was to that. You know, David's concern for his people and for the kingdom of Israel and even for God just seemed to be in this time lost completely and buried up by his overwhelming grief for his son. He never asked about the people, the servants, the generals, what kind of, you know, what happened, how did it take place. He had one concern and one concern only, and that was, is Absalom my son safe? Number four, he is to be blamed because he despised the mercy of his own deliverance and the deliverance of his family and his kingdom from Absalom's wicked designs. Absalom intended to take his kingdom away from him, to kill him, and very likely to destroy his family and all of those servants who were supportive of him and faithful to him. And you know, God's mercy in delivering him, he says it was almost as if there was no mercy. There was nothing worth giving thanks for because it cost the life of his son Absalom. Everything God did for him, it's like, this is not the mercy of God. I can't be thankful for this because it cost me my son. You're not considering what's most important at all. And David did. And number five, for he's to be blamed for indulging a strong passion and speaking unadvisedly with his lips. It's not like he mourned in private. He mourned loudly, weeping loudly and complaining loudly about what had happened and pitifully mourning for my son Absalom, where everybody could hear it. Everybody could hear what he's doing. And that you know, had a big part to do with the problems that were going to happen in this nation after this. You know, again, we look at this, and I think you hit it on the head a minute ago when you said self-pity. That's really what's going on here. He has become so wrapped up in himself and pitiful, pitiful me. The loss of his son is really pitiful me, I think, is what David is really expressing here. And you can, again, see how his moral decision-making has degraded. Look in chapter 19. Let's move on. Joab hears what's going on. Joab's not there with him, so he hasn't seen all this for himself. But he hears about it. Look at verse 9, chapter 19, verse 1. Joab was told, "Behold, the king is weeping and mourning for Absalom." And so he says, "So the victory that day was turned into mourning for all the people. For the people heard it said that day, 'The king is grieved for his son.' And the people stole back into the city that day, as people who are ashamed steal away when they flee in battle. But the king covered his face, and the king cried out with a loud voice, 'Oh, my son Absalom, oh, Absalom, my son, my son.'" So he's loudly weeping and grieving and mourning his son, and everybody sees it. Everybody hears it. Everybody watches what he's doing. The king has covered his face. The king is loudly crying out and mourning for his son Absalom. Is the king rejoicing in the great victory God has given his nation that day? For the deliverance that God has given from the rebellious people who, you know, raised this insurrection against the king? This should be for Israel what? What should this be?
A day of celebration.
This should be a day of celebration because God has brought that nation to the place where that nation and those people need to be. And that is back under the anointed king. Because, you know, Absalom wasn't anointed by God. David was anointed by God as king. And so it should be a day of celebration, but the people look around at their king, their leader, their military leader, their political leader, but in many ways should be their spiritual leader as well. And what do they see? He's grieving for his son. That's the only thing he cares about. So what do? Look at verse 3. The people stole back into the city that day. They went back to their own homes, their own tents, as people who are ashamed steal away when they flee in battle. But they're not acting like they're the victors. They're acting like they're the defeated. They're the losers. And they go back home with their tail between their legs is what they do. Why? Because that's what they have seen. That's the example that's been set before them by their king. And so, you know, the king is covering his face. I don't know if that means he's just because he's mourning or if he just doesn't want to see. Maybe he wants to put blinders on to what he's actually doing here. He doesn't want to watch what's happening to the people. He only cares about, he says, I just want to focus on one thing, and that's the loss of my son. So he cries out and mourns Absalom. Well, Joab comes, verse 5. Joab came into the house to the king, came straight to the king, and he said, today you have disgraced all your servants who today have saved your life, the lives of your sons and daughters, the lives of your wives, and the lives of your concubines, and that you love your enemies and you hate your friends. For you have declared today that you regard neither princes nor servants. For today I perceive that if Absalom had lived and all of us had died today, then it would have pleased you well. Is that straight talk? Exactly. He says, now, therefore, arise, go out, speak comfort to your servants. For I swear by the Lord, Jehovah, if you do not go out, not one will stay with you this night. And that will be worse for you than all the evil that has befallen you from your youth until now. Now, Joab kind of lays it straight out there what he needs to say, does he not? And, you know, this should have been a day of celebration. He says, you've made it a day of disgrace. He says, you have disgraced, he says, all your servants. Because all those people fighting in the army, all those people in the troops and the leaders and so forth that went out and put their lives on the line for David that day. You know, he says, you've disgraced us. Your behavior and what you're doing right now is disgracing us. You have disgraced all your servants because we saved your life today. By defeating those the troops that were under Absalom and killing Absalom, he says, we've saved your life. Because that's what they were intent on doing. They were going to kill David. Not only that, we've saved your sons and your daughters, your family, the lives of your wives and your concubines. Your whole family was saved. Because if Absalom had had his way, he would have killed everybody. That'd be my estimation. He would have killed everybody. That's why he liked Hushai's plan better than Ahithophel. Because Ahithophel was going to go out and just kill David. Everybody else would come back. Absalom knows that that's probably not the best thing to do. We can need to kill David and all of his family. Anybody else who might be a threat to my sitting upon the throne needs to die. He would have done that. He says, we've saved all of you. He says, you obviously love your enemies and hate your friends. He says, you have declared today by your behavior, by your weeping, by your mourning, by your wailing for your son, you have declared that, you know, we're nothing. Your princes, your servants, we're nothing to you. He says, I'm sure it would have pleased you if all of us, if Absalom had been kept alive and all the rest of us were dead, you'd have been happy with that. Now, is all that true? The way David's showing himself right now and behaving right now and feeling right now, I'd say yes. I'd say it is true that all of that's the case. He says, you need to do something about it. Look at verse 7. When does he need to do it? Now. You need to change things right now. Now, therefore, based on this, you need to get up. Arise. Get off of your bed of mourning. He says, and you need to go out. Leave this chamber where you're holed up here mourning and crying where everybody can hear you. You go out and you speak what? Comfort to your servants. Because right now, all of his servants, all those people who have heard all of this, they've got to be confused. What am I supposed to feel? I thought we just won a great victory, and here the king is mourning. What am I supposed to feel? How am I supposed to react to this? He says, they need comfort. They need comfort. You don't need any more comfort. That's what's going on. You're trying to comfort yourself in self-pity. But he says, they need comfort. For he says, for I swear by the Lord, I take an oath by Jehovah, if you do not go out, not one person will stay with you this night. You're in danger of losing the whole nation of Israel. Nobody will follow you after this if you don't stop this right now. If you don't stop this right now. He says, and what will happen is things will be worse for you with that situation than anything you've ever experienced in your life from the time you were a youth. It'll get worse. And I think he was absolutely right. I think when Joab says all of this, I think he's told the truth. I think he's told David what he needs to hear. Now, let me cushion that a little bit with these words as well. I don't think we'd be wrong in saying, has Joab demonstrated that he has no compassion for David? It's hard to see any compassion in that. He's angry. He's angry, and he puts straight forward what David needs to hear. No question about that. I don't think that he should have held back on what he said. But think about the way he said it. Has David lost a child? And is that not a reason for some grief at least? I think so. And I don't think Joab cares about that. I could be wrong, but just looking at Joab and looking at how he's behaved and what he's done throughout his life, I don't think he cares about David and has any compassion for David at all. He didn't hesitate one bit, did he, in killing Absalom, did he? He didn't hesitate one bit. In fact, I think there was probably almost some satisfaction in his heart for doing that. So he doesn't have any compassion. The problem and the reason maybe he doesn't have any compassion for David is, let me ask this, do you think David has his respect? See, I don't think so. Now, that's my personal evaluation. I think David has lost all respect with Joab. And I really think, I think that's fairly evident too. When you look at Joab's actions, and I think we talked about this last time, Joab, I think, has demonstrated by his actions that what he does in his life, the choices that he makes, are done primarily to benefit himself. It's still to his advantage for David to return to the throne. Because what's his position? He's the commander of David's army. Okay, so if David returns to the throne, in a sense, he returns to the throne. He returns to a position of power and authority, and he likes that, and he wants that. And so I think that's what he's doing. Again, David needs to hear this. David needs to be shook out of this self-pity and so forth, and this was effective. And David was wise to listen to it. He was wise to listen to him. Sometimes we hesitate to listen to people that we're not real happy with. Do you think that David is happy with Joab? Does he eventually find out how Absalom died? I think he probably does. Joab's first one threw a spear at him. Three of them, in fact. Threw his heart. So he was probably the one who gave the death blow to him. He knows that. And so David recognized that. But he also recognizes, I think he's alert enough here to recognize, this is good advice. This is what I should be doing. And he kind of comes to his senses a little bit. Look at verse 8. The king arose, just as Joab instructed. He heeded this advice, even though it was given in a very insolent manner. Okay, he heeds the advice. He arose and he sat in the gate. He moved down from the chamber above the gate and he sits in the gate publicly where everybody can see him. He says, and they told all the people, saying, there's the king. He's now sitting in the gate. And he's no longer mourning and weeping and wailing. He's there. And so all the people came before the king, for everyone of Israel had fled to his tent. When they hear about it, they come out of their tents, they come out, and they come to the city gate, and they present themselves before the king. Now, all the people were in a dispute. Not just the people there in this city, but the people throughout all the tribes of Israel. When this news spreads throughout all the tribes of Israel, what's happened? That Absalom has been killed, that his troops have been defeated. Then there's a dispute, and they're saying, the king saved us from the hand of our enemies. He delivered us from the hand of the Philistines, and now he's fled from the land because of Absalom. He says, we had a pretty good king. He won great military victories for us. Particularly, he won great victories over our most hated enemies. That's the Philistines. He says, then when Absalom came to power, he fled. What were we going to do? He fled. Now, verse 10. But Absalom, whom we anointed over us. Notice, who didn't anoint Absalom? God didn't anoint him. We anointed him. We anointed him over us. Now he's died in battle. Now, therefore, why do you say nothing about bringing back the king? Because they're in a mess, aren't they? The one who was acting as their king, Absalom, the one they anointed to be their king, he's dead. They don't have a king. Their king is where? He's across the Jordan River. He's in the land of Gilead. He's not even in the land of Canaan. Who's leading the nation of Israel? And what happens if their enemies find out that nobody is leading the nation of Israel? And that Israel has been engaged basically in a civil war. Not a very long one, but it's still a civil war that's got to cripple their army a little bit. And especially with nobody to lead. And they're worried. How come nobody has gone to David and asked him to come back? That's basically what they're disputing about. And I'm assuming here that they're probably questioning their leaders, their elders. The elders of the tribes and so forth. But who was it that departed from David? Absalom led the charge, led the rebellion. But where did he get people from? from all these tribes, including the elders of each one of the tribes. They supported Absalom in this rebellion. And so the elders, I'm sure, are listening and say, well, why haven't they done anything? Why haven't they gone to David and said, we want you to come back and be our king? I mean, that's the best thing to do, is it not? He's the only one anointed by God to be their king. Why not bring him back? Think about all the great military leader that he is. And he's just demonstrated that again by defeating a much larger army led by, you know, Absalom, his son, and so forth. So, you know, I think one of the problems is, what happens if he comes back? So let's start with the first question. What happens if he refuses to come back? I don't know why he would do that, but you get your feelings hurt, feel self-pity. Maybe you say, I'm not going back and lead that people. Look what they did to me. Or what happens if he does come back? What does he do about all those elders who sided with Absalom and rebelled against him? What might come upon them? Retribution, death. I mean, that, and so they're gonna worry about that thing. And so the people are crying that out, and I'm sure news of that gets back to David, and David hears those things. And so what does he do? Verse 11. So David, King David, sent to Zadok and Abiathar the priests. He goes to those who are the spiritual leaders of the nation. Okay, the priests, whom people, I think, for the most part, still respect and look up to. And believe that they're going to get wise counsel and probably unbiased counsel from these men. So he goes to the priest saying, speak to the elders of who? Judah. Not the elders of all Israel, but the elders of Judah. Why Judah? What's significant about the tribe of Judah?
They're in Jerusalem.
That's part of it.
David's tribe.
That's David's tribe. This is David's own people, David's family, David's tribe. So he says, you go speak to the elders of Judah, saying, why are you the last to bring the king back to his house? I don't know that they were the last. Nobody's brought him back to the house, but he kind of motivates them, I guess you might say, stimulates them to do something here. He said, why are you the last to bring the king back to his house, since the words of all Israel have come to the king to this very house? I hear how Israel's talking about they need to bring me back. He said, I haven't heard anything like that from you. You see, David knows something needs to happen to get things moving. That the people are kind of paralyzed. The elders are sort of paralyzed. They're not doing anything to go to him and bring him back. And that needs to happen. So he, you know, basically initiates his own tribe to do that. Now, not only does he speak to the elders of Judah, you look at verse 12. He says, you are my brethren, you are my bone and my flesh. Why then are you the last to bring back the king? Because he wants them to initiate this and ask him to come back. And he's talking to the elders. Now, he does one other thing. Look at verse 13. And say to Amasa, are you not my bone and my flesh? God do so to me and more also, if you are not commander of the army before me continually in place of Joab. Now, do you remember who Amasa was? He's the one that Absalom made commander of his army. And he willingly took that position. He's the one who led this rebellious army against David out into the crossing Jordan out there to do what? To kill David and probably his family too, and all of his servants and all of his supporters. Amasa led that. Now, David is saying what? He says, I'm going to do what? I'm going to make you commander of my army. And he swears by God, God do so to me and more also, if you are not commander of the army before me continually in place of Joab. He swore to him by God he would be the commander of the army in place of Joab. Now, in looking at this statement, there's several things that become evident. Number one, David is expressing, I think, his willingness to do what?
Forgive.
Even the man who led the army of rebellion, he has now told him, I'll make you commander of my army. So he's willing to forgive. And, you know, how many people have, you know, where have all the rebellious people come from? From all Israel, from all tribes of Israel, including his own, the tribe of Judah. And yet David is willing to forgive, I think, and to bring them back. Now, again, you have to consider, Amasa is David's nephew. That probably enters into it a little bit, too. He is his nephew, which is, again, you know, you're kind of surprising this. But the other thing is that David is resolved to do what? What's the other thing he's resolved that he's going to do, for sure?
Replace Joab,
which lets you see, how does he feel about Joab now? And why? He's the one who killed Absalom. So you see, he's going to hold it. But I think through this gesture, particularly with Amasa, this is a sign to Judah and to all the tribes that David is willing to return is willing to basically say, all is forgiven, all is forgotten, let's continue on, let's continue to live as a nation that are God's chosen people. Verse 14, the results of all of this, and so he swayed the hearts of all the men of Judah, just as the heart of one man, so that they sent this word to the king, return, you and all your servants. Now, the interesting thing here is determining the person in verse 14, who is he? He swayed the hearts of all the men of Judah, just as the heart of one man, so that they sent this word to the king, return, you and all your servants. Now, you see, who could that be? Is it Amasa? With David's words to Amasa and the promise he made to him, did Amasa go back and sway all the hearts of Israel? Was it David, by his actions and his words to Amasa? Is he the one who swayed all the hearts of the men of Judah so that they were all united as one man to ask David to return? Who else could he be?
One of the priests.
Could be one of the priests, that's a possibility. Who else? You know, I don't think that. Not in that case. Joab just mentioned. He's not one of the people actually doing this. Yeah, it's possible. Don't know this for sure. That the one who swayed all these hearts is God. Is God, because whose will is being carried out here? It could be that God, in His providence, used David to sway the hearts. It could be that God, in His providence, used Amasa to do that. Ultimately, though, the one who swayed the hearts, the one who brought this nation to ask David to return, I think, is the Lord. And that's what they said. Return you, and who else? All your servants. All of those that fought against us, all of those that defeated us, all of those that slaughtered our people. He says, I want you all to return. Because they realize that's what this nation needs, is they need to be reunited under a powerful leader, and they know that the only one who could take that position is David. Now, if we look at this, things now seem to be moving in the right direction. But which tribe was swayed? Judah. How many tribes are there? There's 12 tribes, don't you know? What about all the other tribes? I mean, Judah is an important part. Okay, that's where Jerusalem is. That's the royal tribe and so forth. But there are 11 other tribes here, including the Levites, you know. So at least 10 other tribes specifically that are not the Levites, they need to be persuaded, do they not, too? You see, David's move may not be as wise as he had hoped, because he has focused on one group of one part of the nation. He has focused on his own tribe, the people of Judah. How do you think the rest of the tribes are going to feel about this? We're going to look at this next time. You know, when we look at this situation with David, one of the things missing in all of these events is this statement, and David inquired of the Lord. Nowhere in any of this where we read, you know, do we see David inquiring of the Lord? Do we asking God's direction? Lord, what do you want me to do? You know, I've been living in sin. I've been living, you know, wallowing in self-pity. I need to know what your direction is for my life. And nowhere do we see that. David is still walking in many ways in his own ways, listening to the wisdom that he would put forth himself, listening to the wisdom that others would put forth. David's still reaping what he sowed. You know, Galatians chapter 6, verse 7 says, whatsoever a man sows, that shall he also reap. David sowed sins, you know, the seeds of sin. And his past sins have consequences. We've seen that already. A sword shall not depart from your house throughout your entire lifetime. And we've seen that in a terrible way. And it's meant destruction not only for David's family, but for David's people, the nation of Israel. We've seen guilt and sorrow and a fear that is in David, his inordinate affection for his son and his grief when he died, affecting his decisions and his judgments, particularly morally. We've seen it's affected his attitude and his actions toward his children, his attitude and his actions toward the kingdom that he's to be the ruler of, and his attitude and his actions toward God. All of that's been affected by his sin. That's what happens when we get caught up in sin and we don't acknowledge that sin to God and you know, yield to Him, yield control to Him. God's will is to restore David as king. And you think about the promise of 2 Samuel 7. Your throne and your house are going to be established how long? Forever. Forever. So we know David's going to sit on the throne again. It's not going to go to someone else. And so it will be accomplished, but it's going to be accomplished, you might say, in this, in spite of David. Not necessarily because of David in these cases, but in spite of David and what he does. So we're going to see how this continues next time. Not next week. Next week is camp, so we'll not meet next week. But the following week, we'll look and see how the kingdom is restored to David. And it's not a simple process. It's not an easy process. It's a bumpy process. And we almost get a little bit of foreshadowing of what's going to happen after the days of Solomon, when this kingdom gets split. And you see the lines that went along which it will split, even in what happens the next time or so. Well, let's continue. We'll continue this next time. Let's close in prayer. Father, we again thank you that we could spend this time in your word and just let your spirit take these events that took place in the life of David and looking at his decisions and Joab and the other people involved and to see how you worked out your plan and purpose in their lives and to learn lessons from this, Father. Sometimes we need to see the negative examples that are here and learn lessons of things that we don't want to do in our own lives. And we just pray that we'll learn from this tonight and realize how important it is, Father, to seek your will in all that we do and to trust in you no matter what happens in our lives. And to realize, Father, how there are consequences to sin in our lives and to guard against it, to guard our hearts, to guard our minds, and to be aware, Father, of how we need your wisdom. We need your power working in and through us every moment, every day, so that we can do what is pleasing to you. We can be used to accomplish your purpose that you have for us on a daily basis. We just pray that you will guide and direct us throughout this week, and we continue our lives and our service for you, and use us, Father, as your servants for your glory. We just pray for the camp that's coming up next week, and ask your blessings upon the giving forth of your word at that place, and just pray that your name will be honored and glorified, and the people that come will be touched by the power of your word in their lives as they trust and believe in the Lord Jesus Christ. And we just commit ourselves to you in all that we do. In Christ's name, amen.